Well, good day. Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Today's program features Missouri Poet Laureate William Trowbridge. His topic is Why So Few Americans Read Poetry Who Aren't Assigned to Read Poetry. He's finishing out his term as Missouri's Poet Laureate. He's going to also share with us some poems from his brand new book, Put This On, Please, New and Selected Poems. This program was recorded on Sunday, April 27th, at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. You might have also noticed we're trying out a new theme song for All Souls. The background music that you're hearing as I say this is composed by Fred Potter, who is a local musician and composer, as you can tell, who plays all the instruments on this track as well. So I hope you like it. We'll test it out and see how the reaction is to this. And we'll use this as our intro and outro and probably put it on our promos as well. So hope you like it. Let us go directly to the introduction, and then we will hear from Mr. Trowbridge.
Good morning. Welcome to All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church and to our forum, which has been holding these sessions since 1943. So younger than some of us, older than some of us. I would like to have a lot more people for whom that's way before they were born. Today we have with us our Missouri Poet Laureate, and this is his second appearance here at a forum. Bill Trowbridge, who also has the distinction of being a member of All Souls, so many of us know who he is and also know his wife, Sue. I'm not going to give any introduction to him other, again, than repeat that he's Missouri Poet Laureate, which is an honor for him, as well as all the people who know him. So, Bill?
Well, good morning, and thanks for coming. I guess the title of my talk was a little bit provocative, which I intended it to be. But I sort of got the idea for this talk from someone in the church. I can't remember who it was, after one of the services came up to me and said, you're the poet laureate. I'm trying to read some modern poetry, and I just don't get it. Can you explain it to me? It just seems too hard. I was sort of struck by that, and so struck that I was kind of fumbling around for an answer. And if I've had my wits about me, I would have said, "You're probably reading the wrong poets." So I'm going to talk a little bit about that today. You know, that remark that he made sort of also reminded me how, sadly, I think, the audience for poetry in this country, at any rate, is relatively small compared to the audience for novels, short stories, whatever. And there's a lot of attempts to make it larger, but so far the progress has been fairly slow. This is in contrast to other countries, I think, where poetry is not considered this sort of esoteric thing that non-specialists don't want to get involved in very much. In Latin America, for instance, diplomatic positions are awarded sometimes to the best poet or best, male or female poet in the country. Pablo Neruda, the famous Chilean poet, was not only given a diplomatic position, but he was elected to the Chilean Senate. And I often wonder how far you would get in this country running as a poet. I'm not so sure you would get all that far. So it reflects a rather different attitude. There's also a little anecdote I was told, and I've forgotten the poet who was sent by the State Department on a world tour, an American poet, and was booked into a tool and die factory in Moscow, and he was to give his poetry reading at quitting time at the tool and die factory. And imagine the audience that you would get in this country. The guys are just getting off work. Let's go to a poetry reading. Probably not. Well, the audience was, as I recall, over 1,000 people showed up to this. Not most of the people in the tool and die factory, and a whole bunch of people who had heard about this poet going to read there and who sort of gravitated towards it. So again, a reflection of the difference between poetry's reputation in America and poetry's reputation in a number of other countries. There's been all sorts of attempts to try to explain why this is, and I guess I'll make an attempt to give a couple of reasons. One of which I think is for the person on the street, poetry has a reputation of being very difficult, if not impossible to read, of being very lofty and refined, and perhaps only for lofty and refined people. And if it's going to aspire to be good or great poetry, serious poetry, it's also humorless. And this all sort of reduces, finally, I think, to the notion that if I'm going to pick up a poem and read it, it's not going to be an enjoyable experience. It's going to be good for me, they say. It's culture, and so I should take it. But it's kind of like medicine. It's good for me. I have to take it. But remember that cough syrup mother used to give you? You know, with the had the horrible rank taste to it, but you knew it was good for you, so you took it. The problem is. This particular medicine we're talking about, a spoonful of sugar doesn't help it go down all that well. So I think this is a misconception, of course, but it's one that's hung on and on and on in this country, it seems to me, in the minds of a lot of people, and helps keep the audience rather small. Also, T.S. Eliot, I'm sure you've all heard of him, or most of you heard of T.S. Eliot, a very famous poet, actually born in St. Louis, left this country, though, after a while. T.S. Eliot declared, among other things, modern poetry should be difficult. Modern poetry should be difficult. And I think what he was talking about is that we live in the modern world as compared to the old times, whatever they are. That the world has become a very complicated and sometimes contradictory and difficult to place to inhabit. And so that modern poetry should reflect those kinds of tensions if it's going to be relevant to its time. Poetry is, I suppose, difficult in a way in comparison to prose in that it tends to work sometimes express itself less directly than prose. It uses figurative language probably more than prose. It sometimes does not organize itself in a nice neat package like a good essay does or a short story, although those concepts are sort of getting eroded a little bit in the other genres as well. But Edgar Allan Poe, in an article called The Philosophy of Composition, as I recall that's what it is, said, in fact, that poetry is something that requires much more intense concentration than prose. Therefore, he said, a poem should not be longer than 100 lines. I don't know where he got that nice round figure, but after 100 lines, he says, a poem becomes not a poem anymore, but a series of poetical effects. By that, he's talking about you can't maintain your concentration. Ordinary human can't concentrate that strongly for that long. And after 100 lines, you start fading in and out. I know you remember when I'm sure you had the experience, you've been reading a book and you're getting tired and you can't remember what was on the last page. It's that kind of effect that Poe says will occur because you need this extra concentration. But I don't think that either Poe or Eliot meant that poetry should be inaccessible to the non-specialist. I don't think they meant that at all. The problem in recent developments, I think, is that poetry is, or a certain kind of poetry, is becoming less and less accessible to the non-specialist. The movement referred to as postmodernism, which includes a sort of philosophical stance called deconstructionism, which applies to not only life but language, has reduced or thrown away, if you will, the old notions that we have of reading something with that's in a context that has a meaning that's accessible to non-specialists. The theory about language that applies here is that language is this sort of arbitrary set of words that we assume apply to what they are supposed to refer to, but that the application is rather arbitrary, and language itself becomes arbitrary if you start looking at it closely enough. If you look at a literary text, you can interpret it pretty much any way you want to, because you're interpreting it from a subjective point of view. And so, so the poetry, it is thought should suggest this kind of world of where beneath the surface it's chaos and where meaning becomes meaningless. There is a certain school of poets who call themselves language poets. Anybody ever heard of the language poets? I've read an article by one of them who referred to meaning in the poem as a bourgeois concept. So if the poem has meaning, it is a bourgeois poem. let me give you an example. This is from and I'm not trying to put these poets down, really. They're into something that is, I think, serious, and a lot of very smart people are doing thinking this way and writing this way. But my point is that I don't think it's helping widen the audience for poetry in America. Here's a poem by Charles Bernstein, who is a language poet, and I won't read you the whole thing. I'll just give you the flavor of it. What are the aesthetic values, and why do there appear to be lesser and fewer of them? Quick, define the difference between arpeggio and Amani. The baby cries because the baby likes crying. The baby cries because the pin is sticking into the baby. The baby isn't crying, but it is called crying. So who's on first? What's shortstop? The man declined to be appraised at the auction at 80% of surface volume, cube steak on rye, amusing twist on lay demo cells, absolutely no returns, damaged goods are the only kind of goods I ever cared about. The lacuna misplaced the ladle, the actor aborted the fable, fold your caps into Indians and flaps. Get it? Okay. Now this is, I'll give you just another example. This is by Ray Armantrout. Ray, R-A-E, is a woman, not a guy. And she is, she has been, I think, 2 years ago was awarded the Pulitzer Prize. Again, an important figure in poetry. But I think, closer to the group of people that I'm talking about. She's not a member of the Language Poetry School, but I think she started out that way. Here's a poem by Ray Armantrout called A Conceit. Local anchors list the ways viewers might enjoy tomorrow. One says, get some great ... but that seems like a stretch. The other snickers, meaning, where do you think you were going with that? Like you thought. Like you could defend vanity in the sense of idle conceit, vacuous self-absorption, doing whatever it takes to whatever, because, really, as if to say, conceit is the vacuum energy. Get it? Okay, there you are again. I think you know, with to somebody with, you know, some experience, Ray Armantrout is more accessible than Mr. Bernstein. But again, I don't think to the non-specialist, her work is very inviting, if you will. So why this? How did this come to be? Again, it's the influence of certain French philosophers who have become very stylish in academia, and the influence of other kinds of thinkers who along the lines that I'm talking about. It also, I think, may be related a little bit to the way poets and poetry get made in this country. If you're going to be a poet, and this is true probably since right after the end of World War II, when the Iowa Writers' Workshop came into existence. A poet, if you're going to be a poet, you go to school for it. You get a degree. If you're interested in it as an undergraduate, you get a Bachelor of Fine Arts, and specialist in creative writing and poetry, and then the terminal degree is a Master of Fine Arts in poetry. To do that, the way you get educated to write in graduate school when you're working on your MFA in creative writing is through what's called a workshop. And the workshop is basically a group of students, preferably not too many, maybe 10, who meet with an instructor present to guide them and who critique each other's works. You bring your poems to the workshop, you read your poem, the class responds, critiques, talks about the good parts, the bad parts, and so basically on and on as you go. It's a good way, I think, to learn your craft as a poet. But the danger, I think, what can be a danger, is that you begin writing for your workshop group, any kind of group that, you know, hangs around a lot together has their own little signals and references and stuff like that. And if you start losing sight of a general audience, and I don't mean an audience of dummies. I'm talking about, you know, decently educated, intelligent people. If you're honing in on this group, then there is sometimes the chance for things to get a little ingrown. And for the poems that are written or coming out of that workshop, the so-called best work of that is appealing to a rather limited and academic audience, because academia pretty much runs the way creative writers are created, if you will, in the way works are created, you know, before they get out of school. How do we start solving the problem if you accept that there's a problem? I think a lot of people are busy at this right now. I would have wished that results would have been faster, but I think things are improving as we go. There are attempts to change poetry, to shift it more towards a general audience. One that you might look up if you can is Ted Kooser's American Life in Poetry. This is a syndicated newspaper column that Ted Kooser, former U.S. Poet Laureate, started to try to get poetry back to the general public. And if a newspaper subscribes to his column, they print a good contemporary poem with every issue of the newspaper. Kooser, in fact, says, you know, people back in, you know, the early 20th century, all papers had poems in them. You know, somehow they got screened out when the marketers, I suppose, got control of things. There is Robert Pinsky's Favorite Poem Project. You may have seen this on public television. This is where he gets people who are not academics and who are not poets to step up and read their favorite poem and have that recorded for people to see. And these will include people from carpenters, plumbers, high school teachers, whatever, people who are not associated with the sort of main line of poets and poetry writers. Garrison Kaler, most of you know about the Writer's Almanac, I assume, which prints a poem with every day. They print a poem, and you can click a little thing and hear Garrison Kaler read the poem. Sometimes I'm not so crazy about some of his selections, but anyway, I think his heart's in the right place, and most of the time he prints really good poems. There is the Poetry Foundation, which has been created and, well, given a huge boost by Ruth Lilly, who is the or was the wife of, I think, Eli Lilly, the pharmaceutical giant, and who contributed most of her fortune to the Poetry Foundation when she died, which was $40 million, I believe. So this has been sort of injected into Poetry Magazine, published in Chicago, and then a whole lot of projects to promote poetry around the country. There's also something called Poetry in the Schools, which has been going on for a long, long time, where poets are sent out to talk about poems, to read poems to kids to get them exposed to poetry that they can relate to, and get them interested in poetry early. I think that, you know, probably one of the main ways of solving the problem I'm talking about is to reach young people in an early stage and get them sort of comfortable with poetry and not have it be this forbidding thing that is held over them like a test that if they take it, they're probably going to flunk. Poetry Out Loud is a something I just went to the Missouri finals. This is a contest where students are memorize poetry and recite the poems that they've memorized, and they do this as a kind of speech contest set up. And there is a recently there was a final for Missouri students in Jeff City, and the winners of that will go to Washington, D.C. for the national contest. And, you know, I used to, when I was a young, dumb kid, I used to think memorizing poems was stupid, mechanical, rote kind of stuff. You know, don't tell me, don't make me memorize things. I want to learn. But I have found through the years that that memorizing a poem, some of you may have poems in your head right now, right? Memorizing a poem, it sort of gets in your blood, doesn't it? Or sort of, it sort of becomes a part of you, if you will. And I know sometimes I can, like, you know, I'm, you know, feeling the need. I will sort of pull out a poem out of my head and recite it and sort of go over it. And so memorizing poems is not just kind of a rote exercise, I don't think. It's something that again, can bring people close to the whole notion of poetry. So Poetry Out Loud, I think, is a great project. There's also something called the Seventh Grade Poetry Foundation, which runs contests for seventh graders throughout this country, and I think they're in Mexico now, too, to who, you know, they write the poems rather than just memorize and recite them. So they have a contest that winds up with a national winner, too, with scholarship money, I assume. There's also a new sort of development called Poetry Slams. Has any of you ever heard about that, Poetry Slams? These are very popular with high school or college-age kids. They're basically contests, but in a poetry slam, there are the audience kind of participates and offers opinions as the poet's reading, and they can be boos or cheers or whatever. And the winner, they usually pass the hat, and the winner gets, you know, the money that's out of the hat. I went to a poetry slam, one of the few I've been to, and there was a huge audience of young people there. And the winner, when they passed the hat, the winner got $250. So I thought that was a pretty impressive little pot for a poetry slam. The thing about poetry slams is that they tend to involve what's called performance poetry. That is a poem that needs to be performed by someone. And if you look at it just on the page, sometimes it loses a great deal. We're still trying to figure out a way to get that enthusiasm that we see at these poetry slams to be switched over to just regular poetry readings that don't involve the kind of theatrics that you often see required to win a poetry slam. So, what can you do? I have a little thing I want to pass out at this point. I myself won't pass out, but I will take a drink of water. Well, while you're waiting to get that, I'll mention a few general things. I think supporting programs that are exposing young people to poetry is very important. If you get the opportunity to support that with your participation or with a couple of bucks, it's certainly going to help. Find a literary magazine and subscribe to it. I've on the sheets that's being passed out, I've mentioned a number of them that I think would be that you would like. And at the top of that list, appropriately, is the the main literary magazine in Kansas City, which is called New Letters. You may have heard of that, edited by Robert Stewart, and which publishes some of the best writers in this country, Pulitzer Prize winners, Nobel Prize winners, non-prize winners who are just starting out are writing terrific stuff. There's also River Styx in St. Louis. Another Missouri magazine, Boulevard, is also in St. Louis. And these magazines, especially New Letters, I think, and Georgia Review and River Styx, tend to print poems that are accessible poems, poems that invite the reader in rather than signal you're over your head. I've given you also a long list of poets that I think that if you're going to read contemporary poetry, you should probably get a collection by one of these poets. These are book titles, poetry collections. You see that on the list. So there's a whole list of poets of all kinds here who I think are writing for the wider audience. No, it's not like there's a tiny few of them out there who are still doing that. There's also the Best Of anthology, the Best American Poetry, comes out as a paperback book every year and prints the editor's idea of what the best American poetry that's appeared in literary magazines that year. So you'll get a selection from lots of different literary magazines. The Pushcart Prize anthology, which also includes short stories and essays. The editors select what they believe to be the best material that's been published in literary magazines. Again, you get a nice cross-section, and it comes out as a paperback every year. The two anthologies I listed, I would recommend especially Stand-Up Poetry, edited by Charles Harper Webb. A bunch of really superb and reader-friendly poems in that. It's a rare anthology, I think, and it's in its consistency of good stuff that's accessible and enjoyable. A lot of poems in that are employ humor and yet are serious poems. Which brings me to the second anthology called Seriously Funny. It just came out, I think, 3 years ago, which consists entirely of poems that play that interesting groundwork between the serious and the funny and combine those two in interesting sorts of ways and are, again, by the best poets that are writing now in America. Some magazines with articles on poetry, if you're interested in reading essays about poetry that are not aimed at specialists, there are essays in Poetry Magazine, published in Chicago, and a magazine called Poets and Writers, which a lot of people who are writers subscribe to, and has some really good essays on poetry, on fiction, whatever. And also the Writer's Chronicle, which is the publication of the Associated Writing Programs, which is the main association for creative writing programs in universities. It's a very good place to look at articles on contemporary literature, basically. With all that in mind, I move now to shameless self-promotion. I have a new book out. It's a new and selected poems. They are, I hope you will find, very accessible poems. I do tend to try to keep a wider audience in mind. And this has a selection of poems from my first five books and then 50 pages of new poems in it. So you get a real real bargain here, if I say. So I'm going to, before I open up to Q&A, because I don't want to cut anybody off at the Q&A part, I will read a couple of these poems to give you a little sample. And some of you may have heard the first one, which I think I read here before it came out in the book. It's my Missouri poem. As the Missouri Poet Laureate, I was asked to write a Missouri poem by the governor. And I thought, I'll just not do it and he won't notice. And then I thought, in one sort of spur of the moment, I'd try one. So it came out this way, and it's called Unofficial Missouri Poem. And I sent it, to the governor and his wife to make sure that they approved of it, thinking that I may well not be the Missouri Poet Laureate after they read it, but they liked it, so, or at least the governor's wife liked it, so he had to like it. It's an unofficial Missouri poem. You won't find 76 trombones in this poem. That was Iowa. No orations about rolling rivers or salutes to emerald pastures, stately peaks, or glittering skylines. Then we've got our share of each. Not to mention 34 kinds of plastic worm in the world's largest bait shop. Or the train station where Pretty Boy and Company shot it out with the law. Or towns like Cooter, Roach, Enough, Licking, Tightwad, and Frankenstein, along with Peculiar, so-called because the state said the name had to be that or unique, and the grave of Harry, who fired MacArthur because I wasn't going to let that SOB resign on me, and the license plate with a bluebird you have to tailgate to see, and whether they can wash your house into the next county or sing it to sleep on a soft May night, and where the state rock is something called Mozarkite. And the bathtubs with feet resembling animal paws are against the law. And where 15,000 souls throng annually to the town of Nixa for Sucker Day to eat their fill of that tasty bottom feeder. And where the immortal Satchel Paige first bamboozled batters with the hesitation pitch. It's the birthplace of Mark Twain, Jesse James, and the coward Robert Ford. Chuck Berry, Tennessee Williams, Charlie Parker, Josephine Baker, Joseph Pulitzer, Omar Bradley, Bell Starr, T.S. Eliot, Calamity Jane, Willie the Rat Camisano, and J.C. Penney. Add to all this the world's largest pecan, the big shoe made entirely of shoes, the cooking from scratch chicken car, the world's smallest cathedral, the Bonnie and Clyde ambush apartment, the world's largest concrete soccer ball, the Jesse James feather duster of death, the Walt Disney dreaming tree and barn, the grave of Pete Kibbe's foot, the home of Throat Rolls, the world's largest fork, the dental health theater, a giant concrete turtle park, the world's largest chigger, cowboy muffler man, the world's largest ball of string, not twine, and the nuclear waste adventure trail and museum. If you think you've found a place that can pluck more tunes on your inner banjo, show me. Thank you. Title poem. People wonder, what does that mean? You know, you're being one of those difficult poets. Put this on, please. I'm sure you've all heard this phrase spoken to you, possibly as you're about to enter the hospital, or the doctor wants to do some tests, and the nurse comes in with that little garment and politely asks you to put it on. So this is my poem about that. Put this on, please. Cut from dime store cotton, fastened from behind at the neck, designed for easy access to your nakedness. It's issued in exchange for your clothes and valuables when they've checked if you can pay. The trick to tying it, their little secret. It may sport stripes or flowers, though most are plain as winding sheets. If soiled, it can be clean or simply tossed. Your robe for the mute choir that haunts the halls, wheeling its tubes and IVs, or tosses in sleep, or just stares dully, draped in this chilly birthright. Thank you. I'm taking a little risk. But I think, looking out at the audience, does everybody remember Abbott and Costello? Okay. They had two immortal comedy bits. One was the Niagara Falls bit, and the other was Who's On First. You can see both of those on YouTube still. Who's On First, for those who've been living in a cave most of your life, the Who's On First is a gag where Abbott says, there's a great new baseball in town. You ought to learn who the players are. And so Lou Costello says, well, who's on first? And it turns out that the first baseman is named Who, the second baseman is named What, and the third baseman is named I don't know. So he says, who's on first? And Abbott says, yes. And Costello says, no, I said, who's on first? Yes, that's right. And it goes back and forth like that. on and on. And then, what are you talking about? No, he's on second. So on and on. We've all done this usually with customer service. okay. Who's on first? We've all played it with the phone company, Light and Power, City Hall, with customer service from somewhere in the Punjab. The teeth grinding to and fro from first to third and back with a nod to shortstop. Who can help me? Yes. I said, who? That's right. What makes my laptop do this? No, he's in accounting. Who? Yes, he could help you. And on, like when my father's mind went Costello to our family's Abbott. What? He'd ask. Who? Then scurry off to shave for the third time that hour, or rise for breakfast at 2 a.m., bumping mother's bed, jangling the car keys, the room transformed to some tilted hall in Timbuktu, north flipped into south, chair become latrine, rocket screaming down from his 10 days in the bulge. Nothing worked anymore. Everything unplugged. Everybody talking crap. Everybody crap heads. Every day, a skit that wasn't funny had no end. I don't know, he'd say. Who? Thank you. You all remember the when motels were actually motels and not standardized. Okay, all right, one more. Okay, she says one more, so I'll do that. Okay. This is called Before Ramada. Ramada being one of the big commercial chains that standardized motels, Holiday Inn and Ramada. So before Ramada, the crazy camp, the wigwam, the step back in, the dude, the blue moon, the it'll do, the just plain Roy's. They're still back on the old highway, the interstate replaced, back there with Norman Bates and the Magic Fingers. Snowy TV in every room, scent of mildew and cigarettes, where exhausted ghosts of mom and dad try to catch a little sleep before the next 600 miles of thermos coffee, of keep that up and we'll turn around right here. The lame duck, the gorilla villa, the cactus, the pig and whistle, the big bunny, the yes, a vacancy. As the kids screech the bed springs and a big rig air horns past in a cloud of diesel fumes and grit, while the couple next door yelps and thuds through their second big O, and God knows who is trying God knows what upstairs with castanets and whinnies. Hot pillow joints, the tabloids called them. Camps of crime, J. Edgar snarled. Our shaky shots at gypsying, long gone astray. The shady lady, the bo peep, the covert, the purple heart. All await the dozer in the backhoe calling, air-conditioned, nice and clean, vacancy. Thank you. So, are there any questions?
You're listening to Poet Laureate William Trowbridge talk about state of poetry and why it's kind of out of fashion in a way. We hope that it's coming back strong. You're listening to the All Souls Forum. We're going to take a short break. We do owe you a few messages, so let us do those. We will come back with the question and answer session, wherein the audience will ask the poet about some of his influences and about his opinions of what is poetry and what isn't. So hang tight. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI.
This is Blair Shulman. My guest on the next ArtSpeak Radio is textile artist, welder, and weaver Lauren Subchak. That's ArtSpeak Radio, Wednesdays at 6 p.m. on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
H.C. Curry's farm is starved for water, and his spinster daughter Lizzie is starved for love. Then, glib, handsome Bill Starbuck comes into town. Tony nominee Jane Atkinson stars in The Rainmaker on the next L.A. Theater Works Wednesday evening at 7 on 90.1 FM, KKFI.
Thank you. This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we talked to Kevin Corley, who wrote a novel called 16 Tons about coal miners, their families, and the struggle to organize. It's based on interviews done with miners who lived it. Then, on Pioneer Women, we discover that, yes, there is Women's Lib at Jiffy Lube. That's Thursday at 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. On Saturday, June 14th at IBEW Local 124, the Heartland Labor Forum will celebrate 25 years of talking back to the boss with two of our favorite hellraisers, America's number one populist Jim Hightower and labor troubadour Ann Feeney. We'll have a VIP meet and greet dinner at 6 p.m., followed by a hell-raising speech and concert at 7. Details, advance tickets, and directions are available at kkfi.org. We do the
work. This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
If the air, food, and water out of which our children's bodies are constructed are contaminated, we can't do our job as parents. If the day comes when I can be a better mother inside of jail than outside, I will be that mother.
This week, it's Farewell Fossil Fuels with Sandra Steingraber and Bill McKibben on The Bioneers.
Friday morning at 9:30.
On the next edition of Global Roots Radio, we will explore what it is like growing up as an Iranian American in Kansas City. Guest host Miriam Zarabi draws on personal memory and experience of difference as an evolving ethnic identity. Tune in to Global Roots Radio this Sunday, 3 to 5 p.m.
Questions, then? Anybody?
Thank you for being here. Do you have any tips on how to memorize poetry?
Well, boy, howdy. I don't know whether I have any tips. You just have to dig in there and memorize it. Of course, it's easier to memorize poetry that's rhymed and metered, isn't it? That's one reason, you know, they started rhyming was to, a mnemonic device to, before there were any serious shots at poems. You probably had 30 days, had September, April, June, and November, that sort of thing, to make it easy to memorize. I would pick a poem that you really love. Because some of that will be stuck in your mind before you even start trying to memorize it. That would be my only tip. The rest of it you'll just have to, repeat and repeat until you get it.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed this.
Well, thanks.
The first time I heard Strange Fruit, it was recited as a poem and not to music. And I've often been struck by somebody who once said, the reason I do folk music is that I can sell that easier than I can poetry.
Well,
and
yes.
I've also heard this from people who do rap, that this is a form of poetry also.
Yes.
Do you have a comment on that?
Yeah. It seems to me that, once again, song lyrics and poems are a little bit different. The song lyrics are made to go with music, and if they get too dense, they kind of interfere with the music a little bit. So. I'm not sure that in most cases, certainly some lyrics, I think, especially people like Randy Newman and Richard Thompson, their lyrics are sometimes, come pretty close to passing as poems. But I think by and large, a person who writes song lyrics is not exactly doing the same thing as a person who's writing poetry.
As a proud lifelong writer of mediocre poetry, I was struck by something that you said earlier in your remarks today about poetry, and I think it was Eliot who said it should be difficult.
Yes.
And it reminded me of a poem that I came to care about a lot. And I'm not good at memorizing poetry or the names of the writers of poetry, but when you handed out that list, I think that his name was on it. I think it might have been William Matthews.
Okay.
And
yes.
He told about a situation where he was in a poem. He described a situation where he was reading this poetry at the U.S. Military Academy. And after he read for a while, he was going to take questions. And a cadet stood up and said, basically, sir, why is it when I try to read your poems, I get a headache? And I thought his response, which I can't repeat verbatim, was pretty important. It was.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you couldn't read because of the language he used. Go ahead.
But at any rate, he said that I, when I'm writing poetry, I'm trying to discover, trying to describe what it's like to be human. And that is very difficult, and maybe it's difficult for you to absorb it as well. But my question is, do you think that humorous poems are as good or better at describing what it's like to be human than serious poems?
It's a good question, and sure. I've sort of take a stand on this because I tend to write with humor in my poems, but try to have a more serious undertone, and that's because my favorite writers do that, I guess. And I think it's part of the human condition. W.H. Auden wrote a wonderful poem called Musée des Beaux-Arts about the paintings of the old masters, or whom he referred to as the old masters, who were the Dutch painters, Bruegel being the main one he's talking about. And he's talking about what makes them unique among painters. And the quality, one of the qualities he's talking about is that they don't, if they're writing, if they're painting something very serious like the crucifixion, they are not allergic to putting something humorous in it or at the side. And quite often, in Bruegel's painting, if there's a crucifixion, it's up in the corner of the painting, and you've got guys doing stuff down in the in the foreground of the painting who don't have anything, don't care much about what's going on. And I will recall this loosely for you. The line that always struck me is that even at the moment of dreadful martyrdom, he's talking about what's in their paintings. Even at the moment of dreadful martyrdom, there is always the torturer's horse scratching his innocent behind on a tree. So there's always that if you're talking about real life rather than those paintings where everything, the crucifixion, everything is pointing towards the Christ, and there's auras and nimbuses and everything, and nobody's not paying attention. Auden says, the real suffering, if you're going to talk about real suffering, you have that mixture of the sort of ludicrous with the very serious at the same time. That's part of the sort of essence of, as you say, being human. So, yeah, I would say humor in poetry is important part of thinking about being human.
Bill, sometime in the last couple of decades, the prose poem has made the scene. Could you comment on its character and development?
Well, I don't write many prose poems, but I think it started out as a way of sort of throwing out an old standard, which is the poem should be written in lines that stop before the end of the page, rather than there used to be typewriters, remember, back in those days, so rather than it just stops when the ding goes on and then you go over to the next line, that sort of thing. So prose poems, I don't know, I have mixed feelings about it. It seems to me that if you're writing a prose poem, you throw out one thing that you can use if you're not writing a prose poem, and that's line length, which can sometimes be very important where you break a line. If you're just relying on the end of the edge of the page to break your lines, it seems to me that you're not using perhaps all that you could as a poet. But I think prose poems are sort of a way of pulling poetry off its pedestal a little bit, so they don't look as poetic as those things that you see. They tend to be certain subjects that lend themselves better to being prose poems than others. It's probably more complicated than I could talk about, right now. But I've written a couple of prose poems, but I don't think they're my best stuff. And there are some poets who do write prose poems that are really good, though. I just wonder if they couldn't, use that other tool, the line, to make it better. Yeah.
'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe. Most of us have heard Jabberwocky.
Yes.
And it strikes me that that kind of poem, because of his lack of ordinary meaning, has something about the essence of poetry in it. What do you think about that?
I do, and I think probably the power of that comes from that it was really, you begin to attach meaning to that word that's not really a word that you've ever heard before. The words are arranged in a way such that you sort of get something, a meaning out of that poem, don't you? And also, I think, you know, part of the appeal is just the use of sound and the use of rhythm in that. It's got a kind of hypnotic quality to it that, you know, Carol was good at that sort of thing. And it's easy to memorize, too, so that's good.
I wish there were more of that kind of thing.
Well, yeah, I think there is if you look.
Thank you for being here and your humor.
Oh, please.
In the beginning of your talk, you mentioned the after-work poetry reading, and then you've mentioned repeatedly about the important, how good it would be if people were reading more poetry. Would you comment upon the effect that could occur if the citizens of the United States actually read more poetry and enjoyed it?
What effect that would
have? Yeah, what kind of effect could that have on a population?
It would enrich our lives, I think. You know, a great poem can do something to you that maybe no other thing can do. And it was mentioned, you know, how to be human, you know, and what being human is. So it can enlighten you and give you pleasure in a way that is rather unique to poetry, I think. And to not ever read poetry, you know, it's not that you're going to die from that, but you know, there's going to be something that could have made your life a little bit richer that you'll not be connected to because of you know, what you've heard about it or whatever. Yeah, John.
Good morning. I was a little surprised when you were talking about the poetry slam and about the young audience it drew and requiring performance. And then you kind of ended by suggesting let's try to draw that back into more traditional poetry. And that surprised me. I thought my first reaction was let's take that and grow that poetry slam side of the world and maybe help it mature if we've got the youth engaged there. I wonder if you might explore.
Well, that would be another way of doing it, in a very legitimate way, I think. You know, I just don't know how to, you know, people have been scratching their heads about this for a long time, and I don't think anybody's come up with a solution to how to get that energy and transfer it into poetry that's not just basically performance poetry, whether you start with you try to work on the kids who are doing the performance poetry, or whether you try to bring them into a traditional thing and work that way. I just don't know. It's a tough problem, but there seems to be right now a real barrier between those two kinds of poetry. What's unhappy is that there's this great enthusiasm of young people for a certain kind of poetry. So why can't we, you know, spread it around to the whole system? Okay, I guess we're. One more. Go. We'll have one more.
Time for one more. I was waiting. Yep. You may or may not want to comment on this. I recently heard a comment by Sandra Steingraber, who is an environmental activist, on the subject of memorizing poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever influences a person to memorize poetry is helping them possess an internal library for the times that they are in jail for civil disobedience.
Well, yes, that's true. Well, you can bring those poems in your head out anytime you want to for any reason. Well, that's true. That's another good reason. and in certain countries, it's a serious reason. Okay, well, thank you all for coming here. You've been a great audience.
Well, this comes to an end for another edition of the All Souls Forum. You've just been listening to William Trowbridge, who is the Poet Laureate of Missouri. He is about to end his reign, and he has a new book that he talked about and read some excerpts from. It's called Put This On, Please, New and Selected Poems. So I hope you enjoyed that. It's always nice to do a show at All Souls on the arts. Hope you'll tune in again next week for another edition of the All Souls Forum. This program is produced and edited for broadcast by Barry Lee. Thanks to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls for their help in producing this show each week. Tune in again next Wednesday at noon for another edition of the All Souls Forum. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.